and swim 400 miles to find your next meal. This is life in the extreme. Frozen Planet 2
continues tonight at 8 on BBC iPlayer.
It's midday and next, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the forensic psychiatrist and psychotherapist, Dr. Gwen Adshead.
When people ask Gwen Adshead what she does for a living, she sometimes tells them she's a florist because she simply can't face another conversation about why she's devoted her life to working with, in quotes, monsters. Gwen has spent 30 years as a psychiatrist and as a pioneering forensic psychotherapist working at Broadmoor Hospital in Berkshire with some of society's most violent and vilified offenders. The author of more than 100 academic books and papers, she recently co-wrote a best-selling book with her friend Eileen Horne for a more general audience. The Devil You Know takes the reader into the therapy room at Broadmoor to try to understand these people, often labelled as monstrous, including serial killers, stalkers and child sex offenders. I want to talk more about your work, Gwen, but first your other passion, and the one that we're particularly concerned about in this programme, music. And in your case, choral music. Singing in a choir is all about listening carefully to other people, isn't it? So do you feel parallels with the work you do as a psychotherapist, listening to your patients?
Very much so. I think there's a kind of musicality and a prosody to the communication between a therapist and a patient. And that, of course, is even more pronounced when you talk about group therapy, where there's a number of voices in play. And most of my work has been as a group therapist. So for me, there's a very strong connection, I think, between the use of the voice in communicating something about one, what one thinks and feels, but also the different voices that one hears. And the thing that I think is really interesting, and increasingly I think is interesting, is about the emotion that gets evoked in people by music and what music then represents for people. And so it's not a surprise sometimes that people will talk about songs that they've heard in therapy or be reminded of music, as well as also things like films and stories and books.
We're going to hear quite a bit of vocal music because you sing yourself. But of course, there is the fact that vocal music employs the human voice unadorned.
Yes, and I think as a therapist, the unadorned human voice is really where it starts. Actually, for psychiatry generally, you sit down and the first thing you say really is, well, where does this story start? And so you're listening not just for the content of what people say, but how they speak as well.
We'll come back to where your story starts in a moment, but let's have the first music. We're going to hear a Gershwin song and one from your childhood in New Zealand and choral music from Gibbons, Verdi and Lauridsen. But first, Thomas Tallis, the beautiful motet If Ye Love Me, in a recording by The 16. Why this?
Well, this is one of my favourite pieces to sing in terms of choral music.
Thank you.
Harry Christopher's conducting the 16 in If Ye Love Me by Thomas Tallis. Gwen Adsett, Broadmoor is, of course, a hospital, but I think the connotations for many people are of something rather more bleak, Victorian, austere. What is it like? What does it look like? And what are the number of patients that are treated there?
Well, it really is quite unlike the kind of mock Gothic parody of the mental asylum. The hospital has always been a rather quiet place, and it's an original form with lots of beautiful gardens and one of the most beautiful views in England over four counties. But now in its current incarnation, it looks, I would say, like a modern, it's a very modern building. It looks like a small provincial airport, truthfully. And it only has about 200 men. And it is focused very much on looking after and caring for and rehabilitating people who have very severe mental disorders.
As a psychotherapist working with violent offenders, what exactly do you do and what do you hope to achieve?
Well, what we do is to try first to get an understanding of how this person's mental state came to let them act cruelly and violently to others, what was going through their minds at the time of the violence. And then we try and parse out the different contributions of mental distress, of intoxication, of childhood trauma, and of just general collapse and chaos. And then we develop a kind of rehabilitation plan that helps people to recover their mental health and by that recovery reduce their risk. And really the two principal aims are to help people be more healthy mentally, but also to be safer.
Reading your book, it struck me that a lot of your work involves getting people to face up to what they've done.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true, because in a way, the only way for people to be safer is if they can really take responsibility for what they've done and kind of look at it themselves. So much violence and cruelty arises from a kind of self-deception. And I think a lot of the work that we do is helping people very gently to come up and take a good look at what they did and why they did it. And by owning that responsibility and that sense of agency, they can then own their future safety themselves.
I was very struck by the fact that you clearly began to find that group therapy was in some ways even more productive than a one-to-one, because other members of the group would help and be sympathetic quite often.
Yes, and this is one of the great strengths of group therapy, particularly for antisocial folk, is that coming together in a group is itself a pro-social act. And then the therapist's job is really, and in group analysis we call it the conductor's role,
yes,
is to bring the different voices together, to listen to the silent voice, to look at the person who's taking themselves out and see how those parts fit together in a dynamic process.
So they're quite powerful musical analogies, aren't they?
I would say so. I would say so.
When you talk about feeling radical empathy for patients, what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, we want to get to the root of this person's cruelty and this person's mental disturbance. And in order to get to the root of something, you have to get up close. You can't stand 100 miles away and peer at it with a telescope. You have to get up close. But for people who are in very disturbed states of mind, you need to maintain a kind of distance. And also, I think it's important to keep in mind when you're talking about violence and cruelty or examining the roots of violence and cruelty, it's important to think about the victims of the people you're working with, so that you don't get caught up in getting almost too close to the perpetrators and only seeing things from their point of view. You have to have a kind of binocular vision in which you see things from their point of view, but also from the victim and from society's point of view. And that you need a certain detachment, kind of compassionate detachment, in order to take up that position.
I get the impression that on the whole, you get on very well with the people that you help. But have you sometimes felt frightened, threatened, vulnerable?
Yes, occasionally. Very rarely, considering that I'm spending most of my time with people who are in very disturbed states of mind. It's comparatively unusual. And actually, Broadmoor itself is generally a very safe place to work. And that's partly, at least, of course, because the people I see often want to see me. They're not refusing to see me. I don't impose myself upon them. But I would say that I have sometimes found myself so appalled by what I've heard and disturbed by what I've heard, that I've been frightened not as so much for myself, but for what happened then and what might happen in the future to somebody else.
I told you that I wasn't going to let you off the hook of asking the question where it all began. And our next music takes us there rather nicely, doesn't it?
It does indeed. This is one of the first pieces of music I learned as a child. I was in primary school in New Zealand, in Christchurch, where I was lucky enough to be born and raised for the first 10 years of my life. And this was a Māori song that we all had to learn, and became a bit of a thing for New Zealanders, I think.
The New Zealand Māori chorale with Pokare Kare Ana.
Oh, that's lovely. Do you know, I don't think I've ever heard it in its entirety. I think there were generations of teachers who managed to get small girls and boys through the first verse. And there was a dance that went with it involving poi, which are kind of, I think they're raffia work balls on. And there's a complicated dance that people, it's a traditional Māori dance to it. So that's a real treat.
Gwen Adsett, at the age of just 11, you flew halfway across the world on your own to go to school in England. How did that feel?
Well, it was scary, although I didn't let myself know how scared I was at the time, as is the manner, I think, for many small children. And I think for many people who are facing a challenge, one of the things that they do is just not tell themselves, not let themselves know how anxious they are. And I think that that's what I did. in a way, it was something I'd been preparing for a long time because it was something that my parents had told me was going to happen. And I think they at that time still thought they might come back to live in England, which was partly why it happened. But it was a strange thing.
Do you think that perhaps made you more self-sufficient, more resilient, learning at that age to fend for yourself?
Yes, I do. But I do think it involves something about being able to accept your vulnerabilities. You see, I think one of the things that I struggled with as a child and then later on as an adult was around feeling vulnerable, letting myself know when I felt vulnerable. And that, I think, is not uncommon for people to feel comfortable with being vulnerable. And when you can do that, then it paradoxically, of course, becomes much easier to reach out to others.
We can move on a little bit, thanks to your music choice, the next one, because it takes us, I think, to Cheltenham Ladies College. But I think it was at Cheltenham that you developed, in a way, a lifelong passion for choral singing, and in particular, the Verdi Requiem.
Yes, our choral society got together with the Boys' College, and a great treat for us. possibly not for our teachers, but did boost the numbers of the choral societies in both schools for a bit, and we sang the Verdi Requiem, and it was a hugely important moment for me in terms of my musical education. Absolutely extraordinary.
Which bit have you chosen?
Well, I've chosen the Salve Mei, which is, I think I've chosen it because it's so hopeful and yet coming out of the depths. It's the way that voice takes us and she's singing, save me, save me. And it is such an important and painful piece of music, both poignant, incredibly poignant, as well as beautiful and hopeful.
Thank you. Gwen, you were clearly physically moved listening to that. Your whole body was almost contorted with the depth of feeling that it invoked. Why do you think that happens? What happens in the brain when you feel like that?
Oh, it is extraordinary to think about. And I don't think anybody knows.
That's the magic.
Well, I guess what's interesting about the word magic is that that's Terry Pratchett's nice idea about, you know, the science that's yet to be revealed and yet not reduced in any way, not reduced to some materialistic account. But I think there is something extraordinary about how these kind of sounds get translated. They felt in the body first. Some people think that they felt in the body first and then coming up through the nervous system into the limbic system, into the orbital frontal cortices, and then translated into feeling experience. So you have the emotional experience physically in your body and then the psychological experience in your orbital frontal cortices, which is then translated back into your body in this constant dynamic. But nobody can tell us why the sound of one chord rather than another evokes these particular kinds of emotions, or why that combination of the voices coming in very quietly, and then the soprano hovering over the top, and that contrast between the depth and the light is extraordinary. And everything that happens in between, the original wall of sound, I often think, with the Verdi Requiem, the original wall of sound. And I suppose it's something about the fact that it takes you over. It involves the whole of your brain and your body as well. Although there's a kind of abstract quality which makes for uncertainty and the fact that, you know, people are having different experiences which you can't always put into words. And that is one of the things that's more complicated, I think, about using music for therapy. We do use music therapy a lot, I'm happy to say, in the hospital and in other psychiatric services. And my musical therapist colleagues have been important teachers for me.
We heard Claudio Abbado conducting the choir and the orchestra of La Scala Milan in music from Verdi's Requiem, and the soloists were led by the soprano Katia Ricciarelli. We sometimes assume, Gwen had said, that people who commit violent crimes are necessarily mentally ill, but they're not always, are they?
No, not at all. And in fact, the vast majority of people who commit violent crimes are not mentally unwell. It's only a minority of people, particularly when it comes to homicide, for example, only a minority of people are mentally unwell at the time of the killing. So the role of psychiatrists is very much really to assist the courts in understanding what role, if any, mental illness plays in the violence, and then if the mental illness does play a role, whether there's any role for treatment in the subsequent management of the offender.
Do you think it helped your work, having experienced postnatal depression yourself, which you've spoken about, that it gives you some insight into what other people were dealing with?
Yes, very much so. I think one of the difficulties is of being a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, when you set out in your training at the beginning of your life, you may not have had a lot of the emotional experiences that form people. And I certainly feel that my understanding as a psychiatrist and psychotherapist has deepened across the years as I've had more of those psychological experiences that transform people and transform their understanding of themselves in relation to other people. So, you know, getting married, having children, being bereaved of a parent, these kind of experiences, including postnatal depression, I think have very much deepened my identity and practice as a psychotherapist. Not that I was a bad psychotherapist when I started out. I was okay, but I think I've become better over the years with practice. And it's like that for many doctors, I think, because there is an art, an emotional art, an emotional intelligence to medicine, as well as the techne, the practical skill.
10 years ago, you trained in mindfulness. How do you use that in your work?
Well, I came to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy because I was interested in the research that shows how psychological therapies work. And mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is one of the few psychological therapies that's been subjected to very intense empirical study of really good quality. And it's been shown particularly to be useful for people with chronic and recurrent depression. And at that time when I was interested in it, I myself had been struggling with chronic recurrent depression. So I was interested in a therapy that had been shown to be helpful. So I went off and trained in the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy in Oxford with the wonderful Professor Mark Williams. And what that introduced me to is a whole domain of experience coming from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago from a Buddhist tradition, but also from a contemplative tradition within the Western Christian tradition. So putting those two things together then meant that I came back to music in a different way, in its meditative components. And that issue, that sense, perhaps more, of paying attention, the way that we focus on the musical notes and the construction of music, how the music then fits together, and how when you sing, particularly in a choir, you have to be so focused. I love that moment of standing in a choir where I know the piece off by heart and I'm just looking at the conductor. That's all I'm doing, and letting that music come into my ears and come out of my mouth.
Well, this next music presumably would be a very good example of that.
Yes, this is Shore on This Shining Light by Lauridsen. I've not sung it myself, but I've listened to it many times, and I think it is a beautiful example of choral music and with a meditative quality.
Kindness must wash for me.
It is astounding, isn't it? It was Mark Williams who introduced me to Lauridsen. I'd not known his work before, and Mark told me that they often use his music in order to induce moods. When you're studying people's moods and their thoughts when feelings, he'd experienced using Lauridsen to induce moods, which goes back to the power of music to induce emotions that you didn't know you had before that music started.
Sure, on this shining night, the third of Morten Lauridsen's Nocturnes, setting James Agee's poem. We heard Nicole Matt conducting the Chamber Choir of Europe with the composer at the piano. You can find details of all the music chosen by my guest today, Dr. Gwen Adsett, if you go to the Private Passions webpage. And if you search in BBC Sounds, you can download a whole library of previous editions of the programme. Gwen, a recent survey reported that 93% of homicides in Britain are committed by men. Why are men so much more likely than women to commit violent crime? Is it imprinted on the Y chromosome? Is it to do with testosterone? What is it to do with?
Well, that, Michael, is a Nobel Prize-winning question, if there ever was one, and so I'm not going to be able to give you a quick or clear answer right now. I think it has less to do with the Y chromosome than it does to do with the available kinds of masculinity that are on offer to people, and particularly to young men growing up. I mean, the vast majority of people with Y chromosomes are not violent to anyone, so therefore, it's something about a journey, if you like. And I know that's a bit hackneyed, but I see a lot of violent young men start their beginning. The journey begins when they're still teenagers. And there must be something there, I think, therefore, about the identity that they build up during that important period of late childhood and early adolescence and young adulthood. And what kind of masculinity is on offer for them? And what role models do they have of a kind of healthy, creative, loving, generative masculinity, which we know is possibly more normal than we know, because the stories of masculinity we tell often seem to be stories about cruelty or control, in particular, control, dominance, and a kind of contempt for vulnerability.
Do you think that there ever are, to use sort of tabloid expressions, people who are monsters, who are evil, purely evil? Or is that just something that is foreign in your experience?
In my experience, it's foreign, in that I passionately believe that we all have the capacity for both great goodness and great cruelty. And so those people who find themselves in an evil state of mind have, as it were, turned their back on goodness and have shut off the light of that. And that can grow as in an accretion, if you like, over a lifetime, particularly for people who have experienced lots of trauma. And there's something about that cruel state of mind, a kind of mad state of mind, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with mental health and suggest to us that any of us could get there. So this idea that people who do evil things are completely alien to the rest of us, I think, is a serious misunderstanding.
What sort of music were you listening to in your days as a medical student in London?
Oh, well, I was listening to pop music, and I was lucky enough to be listening to music, whether it's Capital Radio and BBC One, and like all students, I listened to a lot of pop music. There was the tail end of punk, so I went off to concerts and heard people like The Tubes, who probably nobody's ever heard of since, and I went to lots of different concerts, and I really enjoyed pop music.
And you've chosen a song by the Beatles.
It's George Harrison, Here Comes the Sun. Mm-hmm. The Beatles were not so much around when I was a child. My parents didn't listen to pop music at all, so I didn't hear any pop music really until I was at school or a student. So I came to George Harrison later, and I love this song, I think partly because of the instrumentation, I think, which starts the emotion off right from the first few bars. And then the voice is almost incidental, but the message within it is something, I think, that is, again, very hopeful, and particularly in the idea of coming out after winter, the spring sunshine. And it actually echoes for me something that John Donne wrote about spring coming out after winter. and actually how much fun John Donne would have had with this if he'd had known about this lyric.
The Beatles with George Harrison's song Here Comes the Sun from their 1969 album Abbey Road. Gwen Adsed, what do you think about our love of murder as entertainment, with television crime drama more popular than ever?
Well, I think that perhaps because homicide, killing, is the ultimate crime in a way, because a world ends. When a person's life ends, a world ends. So I think that we're all interested, perhaps, in what it might be like to be in the state of mind in which you end someone's life and almost kind of end your own as well.
Do you watch crime dramas, read detective novels?
Oh, I do, yes. I grew up on Agatha Christie and I love detective stories. And I still read them, not perhaps as much as I used to. I don't like horror books, and I don't like books that kind of focus or celebrate violence. I'm interested really in detective fiction because there's a kind of parallel with what we do. Although the detective novelist, of course, knows why the murderer did it, but we, the therapists, need to find that out. But that process of listening for clues or looking for clues is, I think, not dissimilar to the process that's in detective fiction.
Given the disturbing things that you sometimes encounter in your consulting room, is it difficult sometimes to switch off after work and to lead a normal family life?
Well, I put some effort into it. I think that's what I would say. And I think probably most people do. I think it helps in some ways to go inside a building that has very large, thick walls and a kind of ritual around going in and security checks and keys and those kinds of things. There's a kind of ritual of entry and a ritual of exit, I think, which symbolically allows one to exit too from the state of mind in which you do the work. So that's one thing. I also think having a drive home helps, and listening to music is part of that. So I'm pretty much always listening to music as I go to work and as I come back from work.
It's interesting how much ritual and patterns are important to us.
Very much so. And it made me think, when we were talking now about detective fiction, is that there's something about detective fiction that's about bringing order out of chaos. And, of course, these rituals that we're talking about also help us, I think, to feel a kind of psychological security, given that we're faced with all sorts of things in every 24 hours. We don't know what lies ahead. We might have to face all sorts of things. And I think those kind of rituals help us to feel a bit more centred and balanced.
Singing clearly is a way of letting your hair down, in a way, and relaxing. And in fact, the next piece is one I know that you have sung and love singing.
I do. And I'm particularly grateful to the choir master who I sang with most recently, who sadly, very sadly, and too early, died a few years ago. His name was David Dennis, and he was a very talented musician, pianist, organist, and arranger of music. One of those people who are unfairly talented, I think. We lost a great choir master when he died. And we sang this Orlando Gibbons, Drop, Drop, Slow Tears, and he did a beautiful arrangement of it, which I'm sorry not to be able to share with everybody, but it is a most beautiful piece, and I again think Orlando Gibbons is one of the most beautiful composers of music.
Drop, Drop, Slow Tears by Orlando Gibbons, Paul McCreech directing the Gabrielli Consort. Why do you think, and I can honestly tell you that from over 1,000 programmes, people do focus on music that is sad, you know, whether it's the Purcell, Dido's Lament, whatever, these Strauss Four Last Songs. Why do we as human beings want music that in a way disturbs us?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. But my immediate thought is that we know that life has to come to an end, that our lives are like a great play, a great novel, or a great symphony, and they must come to an end. And there is a kind of bittersweet sadness about that, a poignancy about the beauty of our lives, about everything that we experience. It puts us in touch with that bittersweetness. and actually gives us a way to get used to it and prepare ourselves.
Do you get succor from religious belief?
I'm a person of faith, yeah, very much so.
Does that inform your work?
Yes, I would say so. It isn't true for everybody, I think, but for me, being a practicing Christian has been really important and actually helped me to do the work that I do.
And probably being happy and optimistic must be important.
Well, for me, I guess that's where the faith comes in, because the faith is not so much, and particularly the Christian faith, is not so much about being happy all the time, but more about understanding that there is something beyond our everyday happiness and sadness, that there is a kind of meaning to our experience, and that also that meaning is found in relationships, in understanding and getting close to the hearts and minds of others, and that great web of connection between us. And I've certainly found that the practice of the Christian faith has also enabled me to feel more compassionate, I think, towards evil states of mind, as well as the enjoyment of happiness and goodness.
Well, I think we should end with a piece that is fundamentally happy and puts us in a happy frame of mind. And you've chosen a piece which has the most wonderful melody.
Well, I've chosen Summertime, and it's partly because, it's one of the first things I heard when I came to this country at school, and I'd never heard it before, and it really just surprised me so much. There was something so evocative about it. I can even remember it now, just sitting in this hall, and this gentleman who was playing the music for our school, our music teacher, and he started up the chords and started singing, and I was really transfixed. I'd never heard anything like it, and it remains one of my favourites.
Well, with this wonderful tune, Summertime, it only remains for me to thank you very much, Gwen Adsett, for coming and sharing these thoughts with us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Harolyn Blackwell performing Summertime from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, with Simon Rattle conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra and Glyndebourne Chorus. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Gwen Adshead. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood, and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. The programme returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael's guest will be the neurologist and writer, Jules Montague. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time read for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, has said his party would reintroduce the top rate of income tax at 45 pence after it was scrapped by the Chancellor on Friday. At Labour's annual conference in Liverpool, Sir Keir condemned Kwasi Kwarteng's new economic plans as hugely risky. He set out an alternate approach, which includes generating all of the UK's electricity with renewable energy by 2030. Mr. Kwarteng has defended his package of tax cuts, saying they will benefit people across the income scale and that allowing people to keep more of their wages will stimulate growth. He said there will be more such measures to come from the government. Rail unions say they've held a good meeting with the new Transport Secretary, Anne-Marie Trevelyan, ahead of planned strikes next month. The walkouts, scheduled to start on Saturday, are part of the long-running dispute about pay, jobs and conditions. A man has died in a fire at a tower block in Bristol overnight. The fire was quickly put out, but 8 people were taken to hospital. A number of flats were damaged in the incident, and around 90 residents are being looked after at a local church. Iran says it's summoned the British and Norwegian ambassadors amid ongoing clashes between police and anti-government protesters. Tehran will question the British ambassador about what was described as the hostile character of media coverage of the demonstrations. Iranian authorities say at least 41 people have been killed at protests since the death of a young woman in police custody. A pro-Russian politician has been killed by a missile strike in the occupied Ukrainian city of Kherson. Alexei Zhuravko has been an MP for the Party of the Regions and was one of 2 people reported to have died in the attack. Local authorities in Kherson say members of the Russian media were staying in the hotel, and unverified footage claimed to show a cameraman being carried from the rubble. Italy is expected to elect the country's first female prime minister in the country's general election today. The favourite to head the next government is Giorgia Meloni, the leader of the far-right Brothers of Italy party, which traces its origins to the post-war neo-fascist movement. Hers is the only major party not to have been involved in the outgoing broad coalition. Polls are due to close at 10 o'clock tonight. A super typhoon has reached the Philippines, coming ashore on the most populated island of Luzon, with winds of more than 120 miles an hour. Forecasters say the storm, called Noru, intensified in an unprecedented fashion as it approached land. The United Nations says the current rainy season in Sudan has killed more than 140 people and has destroyed 25,000 homes. The Sudanese authorities have reported that twice as many homes have been partially damaged and that almost every state in the country is affected. And the weather this afternoon, it will remain mostly dry and bright, but cloud will gradually build with patchy drizzle in the northwest. BBC News.
Over the heather, the wet wind blows. I've lice in my tunic and cold in my nose.
Poetry, prose and music, marking the recent return to the northeast of the Lindisfarne Gospels.
Magical carpet pages animating, each lumen, each knotwork, a perfect fit.
Journey from the ancient kingdom of Northumbria to the modern landscapes of the north.
The blue sheet of river, rusty with ships.